Exemplary of the virtues that were embodied in each of the planets. Well, now what happens is that once again we return to the virtues of faith, hope, and love, this time in a positive way, as Dante himself receives this examination. And I guess one point to emphasize is that we see that what was in the beginning outside of Dante, something that he was observing and participating in as kind of an outsider, now we want to see what kind of transformation this journey has brought about in him. So the three virtues are given to each of the three of the most important of the apostles, Saints Peter, James, and John, who become his PhD committee, really, to see how well he has learned not only in Paradiso, but right from the beginning. So we're going to kind of do that, but before we get there, we're going to see a few things that prepare him for that examination.
One thing that Dante needs to know, we all need to know, is that as we look at our present, we need to understand that we build on a series of developments. It's not just about us, it's not just about now, but rather it's sort of the cumulative wisdom and strength of the past that leads us to the practice of virtues. And one way this is illustrated is in the way that Benedict describes the situation in our day. He says, first of all, Peter built his institution without silver or gold, and I, Benedict, constructed mine with prayer and fast, while Francis, his convent, is built with humbleness. Now, how do we operate today? Well, Francis is the most modern guy, but that's not the only thing we need. We need Peter's no gold and silver. We need Benedict's prayer and fast, as well as Francis's humility. That, if you will, what Dante understands is that different individuals and different periods of history encounter different historical situations where one virtue may be more needed than another. But in doing that, we don't kick out, if you will, what's come before, but we build on it. In fact, one of the images of Francis of Assisi is he didn't start building a new church, he repaired the old church. The virtue of humility was particularly needed in that era, and so he built on fasting and prayer, and he built on the lack of silver and gold as a way of creating what was needed for more or less Dante's own time, the time in which the Franciscans were so prominent.
And I would simply add that that's a way of fulfilling a promise that we saw at the very beginning of the Paradiso. You recall the opening lines, "The glory of the one who moves all things penetrates all the universe, reflecting in one part more and in another less." What that means is that all of the parts of the universe are, in a way, traces that can lead us back to God. Dante's trip to Paradiso is to find those traces that are going to do the job best. You can find some of these things down in hell, you can find some of these things in purgatory, but essence of God is going to be found here in the Paradisal journey. So that all of the stuff that we see, what Bill called a kind of cumulative wisdom, can also be seen as cumulative steps or traces that get back to God, and that we need to see them all together. That in a sense, Dante is learning how to incorporate them all into a vision that is total. Remember, we were talking all about separation back there in Inferno. Now we're talking in a very real way about how we put it all back together.
Before Dante is examined by Peter, James, and John, he moves outside the seven planets to the sphere of the fixed stars. And as he prepares to make that move, he's told to look back. "My vision traveled back through all the spheres, through seven heavens, and there I saw our globe, the earth, of course. It made me smile. It looked so paltry there." Dante is gaining vision. We would say perhaps gaining perspective today, that Dante is now able to look at the earth from a radically different perspective than he ever has before. And although Dante is going to go back to that paltry globe and be deeply involved, as we know through the writing of this poem, it's also important to sort of know its place in the scheme of things. And that largest possible context for understanding even the most local problems is valuable.
So that means that the Earth was neither the moral center, nor was it the center of value. That the higher Dante goes, the greater the value. And it's that that he needs to take back down to Earth. Okay, so he gets this examination, three virtues. Peter is the one who examines him in faith. It's kind of interesting because Peter didn't do such a hot job in his own examination of faith. That is to say, the Peter of the Gospels is the one who denied Christ three times. But it's sort of interesting that denial leads to repentance. Repentance leads to Peter's sort of preeminent place. And now, who better than Peter as the one to talk faith with Dante? And it's an interesting discussion. One of the reasons is that of the three of them, faith is, if you will, the most content-oriented of the theological virtues. And so, as a consequence, what we get is an examination which is itself very content-oriented. Faith has a substance. Faith has a content. And Dante is asked, okay, what does it mean to you?
In fact, this examination is described as a university exam. Just as a bachelor, that is, say, somebody in with a bachelor's degree, arms his mind with thought in silence till his master sets the question to be discussed but not decided on, so did I arm myself with arguments while she was speaking, that I be prepared for such a questioner and such a creed. That Dante sort of sitting there saying, well, I'm about to have my final exam, and I really want to make sure I've got all my ducks in a row. Not so I can win the debate, so I can engage in this fruitful discussion. Again, if we think about debate, if we think about the kind of university exams that existed, in some ways it'd be easy to say, well, I've got to beat somebody else. Here, it's not a matter of beating somebody else. It's a matter of being very thoroughly prepared in order to involve oneself in a productive dialogue, that Dante is going to learn things from the very person for whom he's mustering these arguments.
And in fact, I would argue that without that productive dialogue, you don't really know how much you know. That's one of the values of this sort of examination. And so as a consequence, it looks, you know, I was sort of scared the first time that I read it, because it reminded me of many PhD exams that I had heard about, that what you have is examiners will ask you things, and then if you know that, they'll go on to something harder, and if you know that, they'll go on to something harder, because their goal is to find what you don't know. Well, it almost seemed like that was the deal here, that Dante does well in the early round, but, you know, when we're starting to go to the millionaire round, the questions get harder. But I think the point is that we want to see, Peter wants to see, how much Dante knows, because that's good for Dante. The question is, how much of this has he internalized? And by setting him up for this test, we get to see something of what he has learned. After all, we're many, many, many cantos into the journey by this time.
When this examination begins, one of the ways that Dante responds to Peter is to say, well, I know what you've had to say. Remember, Peter's not only a character in several books of the New Testament, he's also the author of the letters of Peter. And I've read this guy, Paul, your buddy, a lot. And in particular, he draws from the letter to the Hebrews, which today most scholars would not attribute to Paul, but Dante would, a sort of good way of summarizing the nature of faith. Faith is the substance of those hoped for things, an argument for things we have not seen. That's not the end of the discussion. We don't end with the definition, because as Ron said, we go beyond a definition of faith to get to the substance of faith. But that's where we start. This is a good academic debate in the sense that before you discuss any topic, you better have the words defined. You better know what people mean when they say things like faith. Otherwise, you have no discussion.
Now, again, since this is about the substance of Christian belief, not surprisingly, they begin to talk about the Bible. They begin to talk about what evidence there is for the truth of the Bible. And Dante does a pretty good job of defending what he knows and how he knows it, and also uses as a kind of interesting proof of the veracity of the Bible, the effects that it has had, that if all of these conversions and miracles of early Christianity took place and the Bible weren't true, that would be an even bigger miracle if they were. So he's doing pretty well in terms of the Bible part of the exam, and doing pretty well in terms of a kind of summary of what is contained in Scripture. But there's also an interesting part that I want to look at that shows something about where Dante is now in this particular phase of his journey. Peter says, you know, what is it that you actually believe? Tell me again. And Dante answers, you want me to reveal the form of my unhesitating faith, and you have asked the reason for its being. I tell you, I believe in one sole God eternal who, unmoved, moves all the heavens that spin in his love and in his desire. Now, the point that I want to make is that that's a kind of paraphrase of the Christian creed, but it seems to have a kind of Aristotelian addition to it in that it's talking what Aristotle would call physics or cosmology as a way of describing this God. At the very least, it's a very philosophical definition. And I think the point to be made in this translation of creed into cosmology is that it is precisely into that universe that Dante himself has been thrust in his journey. So in learning all about the unmoved mover, for example, he's just about to enter that sphere of the universe. And so what he's doing is essentially giving us a kind of heaven's eye view of the creed. The creed and the attachment for where Dante actually is in this journey.
It also reminds us that one of the things that Dante Christians are called to do is to say, okay, here is the substance of the faith as it's been passed down. Now, what do I do with that? Do I simply say, yep, just, you know, not think about it ever again, just say yes to all those things? It's more than that. Augustine will talk about this. The famous St. Anselm in the 11th century talks about faith seeking understanding. That is to say, there are many parts of the substance of Christian faith that can indeed be understood by reason. In Thomas Aquinas' language, some of eternal law is known by reason through what we call natural law. And so for Dante, in a sense, his obligation is not simply to accept everything on the list and move on to something else in his life, but rather deeply to explore everything that is knowable, everything that can be demonstrated by human reason. One of the reasons for that, Augustine talks about this, if those parts of revelation in the Bible can be that are understandable by reason turn out to be so, how much does that strengthen your faith, which you must have, for those parts of Scripture that are not understandable by human reason? And notice where Dante goes after talking about it, as Ron has suggested. Through Moses, meaning the five first books of the Bible, through the prophets, through the Psalms, and through the gospel, and through you who wrote, once kindled by the Holy Spirit's tongue, and I believe in three eternal beings, an essence that is one as well as three, where is and are, describe it equally. In other words, he says, there are some things about God that we can know by reason, and I now know them by faith that has sought understanding. Now there are also some things that we cannot know by reason. We cannot figure out, we cannot understand the Trinity. And he now tells us that he understands that the Trinity exists in that sphere that requires faith that cannot be proved by reason.
Okay, we move from faith to hope. It's interesting that Peter is the examiner in the virtue of faith. John is the examiner in love. That means that the one who's left over, St. James, is the one who examines him in hope. But there's another reason as well, and that is St. James was seen as the great pilgrim saint in the Middle Ages. And pilgrimage is a kind of outward manifestation of the virtue of hope. And also pilgrimage is another way of thinking about, of kind of considering what Dante is going to undergo in his own exile. But this one starts in a very different way. I mean, there was something very academic and scholastic about the way in which the examination in faith takes place. Hope is a much more personal and meditative kind of thing. And it begins with a statement of Dante himself talking about the process of composing the poem and talking about what the poem might possibly do for him. It looks at first as though it's kind of a timeout from the narrative of the poem to talk about something else. But as we've already seen, whenever there are those digressions in the Commedia, it's almost immediate that, or it's almost inevitable that a kind of light bulb should go off in us saying, whoop, important commentary on what's going on. And this is what the commentary is. It's Dante speaking to us rather directly. If ever it happened that this sacred poem, to which both heaven and earth have set their hand, and made me lean from laboring so long, wins over those cruel hearts that exile me from the sweet fold where I grew up a lamb, foe to the wolves that war upon it now, with a changed voice and with another fleece, I shall return a poet, and at my own baptismal font assume the laurel wreath, for it was there I entered in the faith that counts God's souls for him, the faith for which Peter just turned himself into my crown. Well, what's interesting about this is, first of all, that he refers to his own poem, the Commedia itself, as a sacred poem. And then he says that it's a sacred poem to which both heaven and earth have lent their hand. Seems to me heaven in the sense that he's saying, yes, I'm reporting this journey that I had. Okay, so it's pretty clear that it is the poet speaking to us directly here, not the pilgrim. Earth, because, of course, exile itself is one of the subjects of the poem. So heaven and earth have come together to create this poem. And I hope that this is what is going to win over those cruel hearts that exile me. So here you have this statement that one of the goals of the poem is to sort of have exile repealed. Now, notice that it's not on any bad terms. It's simply, you know, recognizing that the poem does have this nutrition, this nutritional value that he talked about before, and that would get him back to Florence. Well, anybody who goes to the Church of Santa Croce nowadays and sees the big tomb of Dante, first thing you need to know about it is it's empty. He's not there, and he never made it back. More to the point, at the end of his life, in Ravenna, writing this poem, he knew that he wasn't going to come back. Nonetheless, the virtue of hope is such that it means that it really only counts for something when you kind of put it in the face of what seems to be impossible. In other words, what we're getting here is a kind of personal testimony that Dante, the poet, still exhibits the virtue of hope. And that it is something, because it's presented in such a personal way, that is very different from the more academically oriented faith that we saw in the previous canto.
In fact, Dante defines hope in Paradiso 25. Hope is sure expectancy of future bliss to be inherited, the holy fruit of God's own grace and man's precedent worth. This is really tough, this hope thing. Because, as Ron suggested, you look at the reality of Florentine politics, and it's very easy to fall into despair. You also look inside yourself and say, gee, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I know what the law of God says, I know what Jesus taught in the Gospels, I know what Paul said we have to do, and gosh, I haven't done that. I haven't lived up to that. I always say to my students, you know, make a checklist involving all 613 laws in the Old Testament, and now put that against your own conduct, and you're going to discover an awful lot of conflicts. It's just inevitable. And hope is really, therefore, deeply rooted in faith. If I have faith in God, the trust in God, then I can hope. This builds one upon the other, that if I trust God and I trust what God said about God's mercy, then I dare to hope. So that, once again, hope is a thing about salvation. It's also a thing about society. If you simply throw up your hands and say, boy, is the world screwed up. Boy, it's hopeless down here. You need to be oriented correctly toward hope, both on earth and in heaven.
When we go from faith as a kind of academic exercise to hope as a kind of meditation, the next step is love, and that's presented as a kind of experience. What happens is that Dante himself goes blind, and then when the blindness goes away, he can see more than he has before. And if you'll remember, back at the very beginning of the Paradiso, one of the things that had to happen for this journey to take place, the word that Dante coined, his sort of new word, transhumanize. Dante had to be transhumanized. This is one of those spots along the way where we see that's in fact what has happened. And so he's ready to go up higher to Seymour to take all that he has learned with him as he moves ahead. So with those three examinations, we now see a new Dante coming close to the vision that's going to take place at the end of the poem.
I want to look what Dante says at the beginning of Paradiso 26, where he talks about love, and he says this: through philosophic arguments and through authority which come from here, such love as this has stamped me with its seal. First of all, notice that Dante says it is both reason and revelation that bring me where I am, and that love has stamped me with its seal. Well, that's very interesting language, because that is exactly the language that's used in describing the reception of the stigmata by St. Francis of Assisi, that he was sealed by God as the genuine article. As Ron pointed out in a previous lecture, it's a seal of authenticity. And it is a seal that comes out of what's called seraphic love in the story of St. Francis. The seraph is the kind of angel that's closest to God and burns red with fire. So here, Dante is having some sort of analogous experience, okay? Through philosophic arguments and through authority which comes from here, such love as this has stamped me with its seal.
We've seen that Dante takes his examination of the virtues of faith, hope, and love. That all takes place in the fixed stars, which is, you've got the seven planetary spheres. This is the eighth. Again, in the Ptolemaic universe, if you look up at night, the stars all seem to be in place. According to this way of calculating, you sort of see them move around at night. That's because they are all embedded in this crystalline sphere that doesn't move with respect to each other. That is where, in the eighth sphere, the examination takes place. What happens beyond that? The ninth sphere turns out to be the so-called prima mobile, or prime mover, which is the outermost sphere of the created universe. As Aristotle says, it's what gives the motion to the other spheres. What is beyond that? What is beyond that, number 10, is what Dante calls the empyrean. It is the place that is beyond space and time. It is the goal of Dante's journey, since this is, if you can talk about it in terms of spatial metaphor, the place where God dwells. And this is the final sphere in the entire Commedia. So what you can see here with the 10 is that there's a kind of interesting way in which you can go back and compare and contrast the spheres that are here with what we've seen in Purgatorio and in Inferno. But I want to make one point about this. When Dante is looking ahead, he's in the prima mobile, and he's looking ahead to the empyrean, what he sees is a point with no magnitude but infinite brightness. And he sees it surrounded by whirling rings of fire. It turns out that those whirling rings of fire are the orders of angels. And what he sees is in exactly the inverse order to what he saw in the created universe. Okay? That is to say, the point itself becomes a distant way of looking at God surrounded by the angels, but what it has done is sort of taken the entire created universe and turned it inside out. Okay? And in looking ahead, what he does is see a very different configuration from anything that's come before, which again, as Bill suggested when we were looking back down at the paltriness of Earth, is another way of saying, here what you have is a kind of transvaluation. You can't rely on either the senses that you had back on Earth or the way in which those senses led you to conclude what was important and what isn't. Okay, this point with no magnitude turns out to be the distant shot that Dante gets of God.
So what does Dante do at this particular point? He takes some time out to talk to us back on Earth about things that seem to us here very earthly, but in fact are part of a disharmony that throws off everything. You mortals do not keep to one true path, philosophizing, so carried away you are by putting on a show of wits. Philosophy is designed to, again, explore those elements of faith that can be understood by human reason. You guys want to do it for scoring points. You want to win a contest. Yet even this provokes the wrath of heaven far less than when the holy word of God is set aside or misconstrued by you. You play games with philosophy. You play games with theology. You play games with scripture. I can beat you at an argument because I can quote this and I know this and I can cite this passage, or I can sometimes even purposely screw up the meaning of scripture to make something work for me, either intellectually or politically. So Dante is warning the dangers here of the intellectuals. Now, how does this affect most of the world? As it turns out, he ends up spending most of his time condemning bad preaching in his own day. Because if you have bad theology and bad philosophy, you're going to get bad preaching. You're going to either get people that misuse knowledge and revelation, or people who simply say, well, I could dwell on that stuff in my sermons, but it's really not very cool. People won't pay attention. I got to do tricks and games and all the rest. And Dante goes on for tercet after tercet after tercet, condemning bad preaching. Way up here, Dante looks back to an even paltrier earth than it was a while ago and says, this is worth talking about. This is worth focusing on. This is really out of kilter with the reality of the heavens.
And notice again, the basic principle here is the farther up you go, the more that becomes appropriate because you see the way things are supposed to be. It's, again, the sense that it never allows us to leave Earth behind, that to use sort of conventional language, it's as though the contemplative life teaches us more about the active life. At the end of Canto 30, Beatrice points Dante to the rose whose petals are the souls of the saved. In other words, this is the reality of which the rest of Paradiso has been a kind of image. The souls that we've seen up until now have been manifesting themselves to Dante so that they could accommodate to his level of learning. Now he sees where they really are. And of course, where they really are is in this mystic rose surrounding the throne of God. And it's very interesting that even here, we have something which is very completely and explicitly political, Beatrice showing Dante something that really continues the political argument that has really been out one of our major subjects from the very beginning of the journey.
There are some empty places, and one of them is pointed out by Beatrice. This is a place reserved for a guy named the Emperor Henry VII, who is alive. In fact, not very well known, in the year 1300. He becomes the Holy Roman Emperor, and he does it with papal approval. But then he decides to do something the Pope doesn't like. He decides actually to go to Italy and become the Roman Emperor. I mean, he's Roman Emperor in title, as others have been. He decides actually to go to Italy. Pope's really irritated by this and opposes him. He descends into Italy, does so-so politically on his way to Rome. Dante supports him. Dante sees Henry as somebody who really does, finally, after a long, long time, understand what the Roman Empire is, really understands that concept of the Roman Empire's universality. And in 1313, as he goes around Siena and heads toward Rome, he dies. And with that death, he's buried in the Cathedral of Pisa to this day, with that death goes any political hope that Dante might have had that in his lifetime, Italy would be set right and he would then be able to go back to Florence. And so I want you to think about it this way. There are two of these folks in particular that Dante tells us sort of in advance where they're going to end up. One is the Pope, Boniface VIII, who sent Dante into exile. The other is the one who would have set things right had he not died in 1313.
In the next lecture, we will see Bernard, Dante's final guide, and come to the end of the vision.
Lecture 24, In My End Is My Beginning.
In Canto 31, Dante begins with a funny metaphor. He says, just like barbarians coming to Rome and seeing all the magnificent buildings and sort of being taken aback, so was I as I came to the vision of this great mystical rose. Dante still has some questions to ask as he journeys right to the real center of the universe, that is to say, God. And he turns around and sort of asks Beatrice a question, and she's not there. We again have a change of guides. What I expected was not what I saw. I thought to see Beatrice there, but saw an elder in the robes of heaven's saints. Turns out that this fellow is Bernard of Clairvaux, a 12th century member of the Cistercian order, a religious order that lived under the rule of Saint Benedict. Why Bernard for Dante's final guide? He was a contemplative. He was an important church reformer. He wrote to the Pope saying, let's get back to spiritual things and put away all this political stuff you're involved in. He was a crusader because he was largely responsible for the calling of the Second Crusade, the crusade where Dante's great-great-grandfather Cacciaguida was a participant and where he was martyred. Bernard of Clairvaux was a preacher, and he was a poet as well. And so, in many ways, this most wonderful mystical figure, somebody who was much better known in Dante's own time, and in fact for the next two or three centuries, than he perhaps is today, turns out to be Dante's final guide to the beatific vision.
I want to say just a couple things about the entrance of Bernard here. First thing is that unlike the displacement that came when Beatrice took over for Virgil, Beatrice herself doesn't disappear. Bernard, in fact, says, see, look, you can see her up there in the mystical rose among the saved. And in fact, he does. And the distance between them also does not in any way mean that he gets a lesser sight of her. At this point in the Empyrean, the ordinary laws of physics really don't apply. So that's important. Second thing is that we're at a place where, as I tried to suggest in the last lecture, the universe has sort of been turned inside out so that ordinary notions of space and time don't really apply either, which means that even though Bernard doesn't get nearly the amount of time that Beatrice did, who doesn't get nearly the amount of time that Virgil did, nevertheless, his importance as Dante's final guide can't be underestimated. That he is, after all, the one who is the final mediator for Dante in this journey, and the one who takes him to what is the goal of the journey. In a way, what Virgil has done was to prepare him for Beatrice. Beatrice has prepared him for Bernard, but Bernard prepares him for God. And it seems to me that it's important to make that point because Bernard often gets lost in the shuffle in talking about Dante's guides. And I think it's important to see that he's there for the very precise reasons that Bill mentioned, but also to say that that's of the greatest importance in looking at the ending of the poem.
One of the things that Bernard does in Paradiso 32 is to point to several folks in the mystical rose, some of whom Dante has heard about and even met in the spheres before, and some not. I would make just a couple points about a couple of the incidents in Bernard's introducing Dante around. He introduces at one point one of the ancestors of David, and he identifies David as the ancestor by saying he is the one who cried for his sin, miserere mei. That is, in fact, the first line of Psalm 50, and it's one of the few phrases that appears in all three parts of the Divine Comedy. The very first words Dante the Pilgrim speaks in Inferno 1 are, have mercy on me. And in Purgatory 5, the souls begin that process of getting ready for purgation by singing it together. Here it's mentioned again. It's another way in which we're called now to put the whole thing together.
What Bernard shows Dante initially is the rose itself and its structure. And it's interesting to see the way in which it's put together. It contains all kinds of interesting symmetries so that males and females, for example, are contrasted with each other. Old and New Testament figures, young and old. And the arrangement turns out to be both circular and linear. Just simply want to suggest before we move on that in some ways this is another example of that complementarity that we talked about in the circle of the sun, and therefore, in a way, the sort of source of that. Remember, we were talking about complementarity, the way parts fit to wholes, as the way the universe works. And that is responsible for both the beauty and the function of the universe. And then we were talking about it in terms of the other cosmos, the sages themselves, who are in those two complementary wheels. Well, it turns out that that's here, but of course we have to look backwards and see this as cause rather than effect, that the universe is the way it is because the mystic rose is the way that it is. Now, what happens at the beginning of the very last canto is that Bernard, as Dante's guide, sings a hymn, a prayer, to the Virgin Mary. And when we want to sort of meditate on why this is an appropriate way to begin the ending of the poem, to begin its 100th canto, I think it's important to remind ourselves that back at the very beginning, there was this this sort of condescension from Mary to Lucy to Beatrice to Virgil. But now, of course, we're going back the other way, and it ends with Mary. As Bernard puts it, that this is the only way to go. This is the only way to get to Mary. And of course, as Bill said, one of the things that makes Bernard so important in the Middle Ages was the fact that he was himself important in promulgating the cult of the Virgin Mary. So he kind of takes on that role specifically for Dante now.
In fact, in the Cistercian order, even today, every monk, whatever his name might be, Charles or Francis or whatever, is also named Mary. This is a very important part of Bernard's personal spirituality. But again, it wasn't just Bernard personally. It was something he brought to the entire Cistercian order. It was said that the white robes of the Cistercians were specifically given to Bernard by the Virgin Mary, in fact. Let's listen to Bernard of Clairvaux's words at the beginning of the last canto, canto 100 of this poem. O Virgin Mother, daughter of your Son, most humble, most exalted of all creatures, chosen of God in his eternal plan. Listen to this language. Virgin Mother, daughter of your Son, most humble, most exalted. It is the language of paradox. It is the only language that will make any sense at this point of the journey.
And in fact, it's also a way of taking a look at the poem as a whole, that is to say, the Divine Comedy, because it seems to me that to have a prayer that is a paradox is also the commedia in germ, in microcosm. We're talking all about, for example, mediation and grace. Dante getting something beyond what he deserves, that was what the beginning told us. And even though we might have, you know, sort of kept that in suspension for a while, here when we get to the end, that's the theme that's picked up. And what Dante says at the beginning of the Paradiso is, we're going to have to try and talk about the untalkable. We're going to have to try and invent a language for talking about things that are beyond language. Again, the language of paradox here serves as a kind of symbol for that. It's what the poem as a whole does.
This prayer of Bernard of Clairvaux to the Virgin lasts 39 lines. And more or less in the middle of this prayer, one of the things that Bernard does is recapitulate the entire story for us. Notice that that's a theme we find in these final cantos, this recapitulation. This is a man who from the deepest pit of all the universe up to this height has witnessed one by one the lives of souls, who begs you that you grant him through your grace the power to raise his vision higher still, to penetrate the final blessedness. What is it Bernard is asking the Virgin for? Will you, O Virgin, pray to God the Father and to your Son to allow Dante nothing less than seeing God face to face?
And in fact, in the lines immediately after that, and I who never burned for my own vision more than I burned for his, With all my prayers, I pray you, and pray that they are enough, that you, through your own prayers, dispel the mist of his mortality. It seems like what he's doing, our first impulse is to see this as sort of rhetoric. That is to say, this is the jazziest kind of prayer that you can come up with as an intercession. But in fact, it also serves to be a pretty good description of what heaven is all about, where one burns in ardor and one burns for things that are not of and for oneself. So that Bernard is sort of enacting a kind of heavenly vision as well as requesting one for the pilgrim. Not surprising, in the central sections of this final canto, there are all kinds of different ways in which Dante talks about the inadequacy of language and the inadequacy of memory to deal with the experience that he's going through, and talks about the great disparity between the two. So that he uses the language, for example, of waking from a dream and knowing by the mood that you're in that something really cool happened in the dream, but that you're not quite able to figure out precisely what it was. And he's saying that that's sort of how I am as far as this experience is concerned. And he also uses the language of forgetfulness by giving us what is generally agreed to be the last explicit classical reference in the poem. He remembers that this was something magnificent. He talks about knowing how the universal form, the fusion of all things, became part of him. In other words, he's talking about how things that are both contingent and necessary in the universe, both are now things that he sort of sees directly and experiences directly. But before he can go any farther, then he says, "One instant brings me more forgetfulness than 25 centuries brought the quest that stunned Neptune when he saw the Argo's keel." Complicated image. Jason and the Argonauts, they go, they get the Golden Fleece, they're on their way back. Neptune, underwater, is looking up and seeing the keel of the Argo go by. And Dante is basically saying that in 1 second, I forgot more of my vision than Neptune has forgotten in the 25 centuries that have taken place since that event. Now, one of the reasons why he uses that particular example, of course, is that he wants to compare this to a kind of golden fleece, okay? That here you have this sort of classical, dimly anticipatory version of Dante's own journey in Jason and the Argonauts going and getting the golden fleece. What makes that so wonderfully resonant here is that Jason not only went and got the golden fleece, but he brought it back. And essentially what Dante is doing is suggesting that his job is the same, that he's going there, he's going to have the vision, but of course he's going to bring it back, he's going to write the poem. So this is the first example in this canto where he really suggests that the event that takes place at the end, this sort of being brought up in this mystic rapture, becomes what generates the entire poem that we have just been talking about.
Because in fact Dante does ask in this last canto, "Give to my tongue eloquence enough to capture just one spark of all your glory that I may leave for future generations." Again, to follow up with what Ron says, Dante not only has the golden fleece, he's got to bring it back. Now, one question we can raise is, in what form is Dante's golden fleece? As Ron suggested, it is in a book. It is in this poem. And therefore, it's appropriate to look at these words of Dante as he's experiencing the presence of God. "I saw how it, the universe, contains within its depths all things bound in a single book by love, of which creation is the scattered leaves." That Dante's job, therefore, when he gets back, is no less than to write a book that mirrors this understanding of all the universe.
Which, of course, means that he's writing it in imitation of the book of the universe itself. And, of course, as we said at the beginning of our lectures, the other book that is an imitation of that universe is the Bible. So here again, support for Dante as writing in imitation of God's own word. And he's really, you know, at the same time that he's saying, "I barely remember," he's setting himself up for this magnificent and monumental task. Well, again, having done that, Then he talks about the inadequacy of language to deal with it. Even in the things I do recall, my words have no more strength than does a babe wetting its tongue still at its mother's breast. So there he sort of suggests that this is baby talk compared to the reality. Compared to what was really there, this is at best baby talk. Again, that means something very different when you've come after 99 cantos, 14,000 lines of the greatest poetry that's ever written. When Dante says it's only baby talk, he has this track record, he has this history of the poem that we've just been reading to suggest something of the nature of the vision that he's about to encounter. And immediately after that, he also says, not that within the living light, remember that point of light of no size but infinite brightness, there was more than a sole aspect of the divine, which always is what it has always been. Yet I learned to see more, and the power of vision grew in me. That single aspect, as I changed, seemed to me to change itself. What Dante is saying is that one's capacity to experience God continues to grow when one has this vision, even though God is changeless, which means, of course, that the vision is, well, never going to get boring. It's always going to get exciting because you continue to grow through it. This might be an appropriate point to just interject that an awful lot of people I know suggest that it's kind of a nifty way to think about the Commedia itself, that the poem doesn't change, but every time one reads it, one's experience of it grows because one is able to experience more. Again, as you know, as we're coming to a close, that's not a bad thing to mention, it seems to me.
And then in this attempt, which he says is like baby talk, within its depthless clarity of substance, I saw the great light shine into three circles, in three clear colors bound in one same space. The first seemed to reflect the next like rainbow on rainbow, and the third was like a flame equally breathed forth by the other two. Of course, this is the way Dante has to describe the experience of the triune God, the God who is three yet one and one yet three. It's an idea, this notion of the Trinity, that Dante has in fact talked about from time to time all through the Paradiso. It's one of the great mysteries. It's one of those things where reason can't figure it out. Thomas Aquinas made that point in the generation before Dante. So Dante's trying to find a way to put in words the experience of something that is totally one and yet three, and not an easy task.
And he continues by the same kind of language to try and talk about that second great mystery of the Christian faith, the idea of the incarnation, the idea that one of these three persons became human. So he talks about that in terms of the same kind of imagery, but then says again, how weak my words fall short of my conception, which is itself so far from what I saw that weak is much too weak a word to use. But he goes on, eternal light fixed in self alone, known only to yourself and knowing self, you love and glow, knowing and being known. That circling which, as I conceived it, shone in you as your own first reflected light when I looked deep into it a while, seemed in itself and in its own self-color to be depicted with man's very image. That is to say, the divine has the human contained in it in some way, because, of course, that is the mystery of the incarnation in Christian terms. Well, how do you figure that one out? Again, as Thomas Aquinas and others have told us, it's beyond the ability of human reason. What happens to Dante here is that he realizes the inadequacy of human reason, but then at the same time, he doesn't understand it, but what he does rather is he experiences it. And in order to present us with the experience, he goes to another very interesting image. He says, as the geometer who tries so hard to square the circle, but cannot discover, think as he may, the principle involved, so yet did I strive with this new mystery. I yearned to know how could our image fit into that circle, how it could conform. Squaring the circle is a principle, or rather a traditional Greek mathematical problem. a square. What is the circle that has the exact area of that square? It was proved in the 19th century that it can't be done. And so I like to think that Dante was sort of prophetic by saying that nobody can do this. But notice that that fits nicely into what he's trying to do here, because, of course, the circle, the traditional image in Greek mathematics and philosophy for the infinite, the square for the human. So squaring the circle is a way of seeing what the relationship is, what the compatibility is, if you will, between divine and human. Well, he's saying, couldn't be done, couldn't do it myself, but so did I strive with this new mystery, but my own wings could not take me so high. Then a great flash of understanding struck my mind, and suddenly its wish was granted. That is to say, not that he understands or can he explain, but is taken into it, becomes part of it, because what he says in the final lines of the poem, at this point, power failed high fantasy, but like a wheel in perfect balance turning, I felt my will and my desire impelled by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. So that the love has impelled will and desire inside of him in such a way that he is a perfectly tuned harmony and sort of living in, living with this mystery. In other words, what he's trying to do here is describe for us this mystical experience.
At the end of this poem, what do? We, the readers, who have come through 14,000 lines, 24 lectures, all the rest, where do we go from here? Well, one of the great lines of Dante criticism of all time is one we need to invoke here. That is to say, when you finish reading the Divine Comedy, you're now ready to read the Divine Comedy. One of the points we've made all the way through is that the parts are related to the whole, that Inferno is not the last thing to be said about any topic, nor is Heaven the first. Not that many people would read the Paradiso first. But rather, now that you've had the whole experience, now you know what's going to happen as we reach this experience of God, now we can read it with new eyes, with new connections, with new understandings, not just of Dante as a poet, as much as that is intellectually rewarding. We can also read it with new eyes in terms of our own experience, in terms of our own understanding of how we deal with this complex, highly articulated and divided physical world in which we live.
Another way of sort of piggybacking onto what Bill has just said, it's very interesting that Dante ends with the vision itself, with the love that moves the sun and the other stars. There's no sense of his taking it back down to earth, though clearly the way everything has been going, what I find most interesting about it is that since this vision is the vision that he ends with, it's the vision that authenticates everything else. This is what gives him the ultimate credential to write the poem. In other words, within the structure of the poem, he's saying, because I experienced this, my poem has a kind of authority. So that by ending, even as it began, remember we talked about its beginning in medias res, in ending in medias res, the point is, of course, that Dante doesn't stay in this mystical trance. He doesn't stay in this rapt vision. Rather, what he comes back to do is to write the poem itself, which is the result of it. And so, again, to look at it in these structural terms, it's an invitation to go back and read the poem again. And certainly, that is the invitation that these lectures are all about as well. I mean, we're hoping that a lot of what the poem is about is now clearer than it was before. But the larger hope, I think, is that you would spend time going back to the poem from the beginning and trying to make the journey, well, as often as you can, actually, make the journey with the help that we have provided.
It is easy to see this poem as an extraordinary intellectual challenge, and indeed it is. It's important that we have some guide, that we have the footnotes and whatever. But if we treat the poem only as a kind of intellectual thing that we're trying to conquer, that we're going to figure out what everything means, I would suggest that that's not the best reading of the poem. It is indeed intellectually challenging. It is intellectually fulfilling to say, I got it. I see this connection. And that in itself is a wonderful thing. But we ask you not to be passive readers of this poem, to be active readers of this poem, not only to journey along with Dante, to try to experience in whatever metaphors come to your mind, with whatever experiences you have to bring to the table, to experience Dante's systematic journey through all the parts of the afterlife. And we believe that you'll find it to be more rewarding than simply intellectual. It will become a part of who you are. There's a wonderful line in a book I read recently that says, people are the stories they take in to be their own story. And we would urge you to make Dante and the Commedia part of your story.
We've had interesting experiences through the years of seeing how that has in fact taken place with some of our readers, some of the people who have been reading the poem with us. One of the most interesting of those, we've made reference to it before, is when we taught the poem inside a maximum security prison at Attica Correctional Facility. And one of the reasons I think we wanted to bring that experience up at the end is to suggest that it not only had this enormous effect on the people who were reading it, but it had an enormous effect on people who were in fact, not Christians at all. Sometimes we run into the problem or the issue of the amount of specifically Christian theology that is here, and it's seen to be a kind of barrier to the poem. You know, there's no question about the fact that it resonates very strongly with Christians and has right from the beginning. But in our experience at Attica, the best students, as it turned out, were Muslims. And it was amazing to see the kind of energy that they put into the reading. And it was also amazing to see the transformation that came out of their reading there. So that was one example that we had of the kind of transformation that the poem can work. And again, as Bill said, without in any way denying the great deal of joy and satisfaction that comes when you figure out more and more pieces of the puzzle, we really do want to make that pitch that that's not the most important reason for reading the poem.
We've talked to a number of different audiences. Of course, we have our own undergraduates who are by and large 19 and 20 years old. And even with those few that we read the entire poem with, probably if you ask most of them, their favorite part is Inferno. It is accessible. The characters are so dramatically drawn. They can recognize certain parts of themselves easily in these characters whom they meet along the way from Francesca on. If you ask our inmates what their most important part of the poem was, they, interestingly enough, said purgatory, because it was a place of moral improvement, and by golly, that's what they needed. We also had the opportunity to teach this course to some of the spiritual descendants of St. Bernard of Clairvaux. That is to say, we taught a group of Cistercian monks at the Abbey of the Genesee, just a few miles from where we live and teach. And their favorite part of the poem was Paradiso. And so we need to understand that at any particular time, a story or a part of the poem may be what most draws you to it. And that's why you need to go back and do it again. And then again, as you bring different experiences and different perspectives, new pieces of it will glow to you and become a part of who you are.
I have one Paradiso story, actually, that took place inside Attica. And I agree with Bill. In fact, purgatory was the part that resonated most strongly with them. But there was one student, we were doing the final exam, water break time, and he's out there by the water fountain, and I'm just there chatting with him. And he looked up, and we had just finished the Paradiso, and the exam had a big question on the Paradiso. And he said, you know, when I read that, it's kind of like I'm out of here. And it seems to me that that's the strongest single one-line testimony that I've ever gotten for the impact that the poem can have on you. But over a longer period of time, you know, we're friends with a lot of people in the, quote, Dante establishment. And one buddy of mine who teaches Dante very regularly said that he was being interviewed for a campus newspaper, and they were talking about Dante. And he said, the interviewer said to him, how does your reading of Dante change your life? And he thought for a while, and his answer was, I don't know, because it's impossible for me to think about what my life would have been without Dante. It's become so much a part of me that I have a very hard time sort of removing myself from it. And obviously, not everybody gets to that point, but a surprising number of people who get hooked on the poem come back to it over and over again and find that it is something that continues to speak to them in the most meaningful possible way.
One way that this journey has been described often in all three parts of the poem is that it's a journey from bondage to freedom. That bondage can be to something as simple as gluttony or as complex as a general sense of being too tied to this world. Read this poem and find its possibility for bringing you some liberation.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at teachco.com. Or you can call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.